Welcome back to the program. The character of Superman first made his appearance in June of 1938, some 75 years ago. The character touched a nerve in the hunger for heroism in the run-up to World War II. But what has allowed this character to evolve and endure for almost eight decades, during a time when virtually everything about our society, our values and our ideas have changed? Superman and what he represents has been a kind of true north for many. What did its creators Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster understand about America that would allow them to create the touchstone for truth, justice, and the American way? We're going to talk about this remarkable story today with my guest Larry Tighe. He's a prize-winning journalist at the Boston Globe, a Nieman Fellow at Harvard, the author of the previous book, Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. It is my pleasure to welcome Larry Tighe back to this program to talk about Superman, the high-flying history of America's most enduring hero. Larry Tighe, thanks so much for joining us once again.
It's my pleasure to be back with you.
Great to have you here. Talk first about Jerry Siegel, the initial creator of Superman, and who he was and how this evolved from him and his kind of nerd-like experience as we would perceive it today.
So for the last 50 or so years, there have been lots of theories on what drove Jerry Siegel to create the character of Superman, what he was thinking about, and the extent to which this whole story reflects his personal story. And we've been speculating on that for a long time. We now have one of the things that came out in the course of my research for this book was a 150-page memoir that Jerry Siegel wrote about a quarter of a century ago and was never published and was never really seen before. And now we have access to this memoir thanks to a lawsuit that his heirs have filed trying to reclaim the rights to Superman. And what this tells is basically the story of a young boy growing up in a poor and almost entirely Jewish part of Cleveland, Ohio in the 1930s. And the boy who every day when he would go to school would be teased on the playground. Kids would come out and taunt him by yelling, "Siegel, Siegel, birds of an eagle." And this is a kid who wished that he could fly away, and what he did was, to escape those kinds of taunts and the humiliation of having that happen in front of the girls that he liked on the playground, at night he would carry with him to bed a pencil and a paper and escape into a world of fantasy. And he initially dreamed up a character that he called The Superman, and Superman in those days was hyphenated, S-U-P-E-R hyphen M-A-N, and also was a bad guy, was a guy who thought about trying to take over the world. And so he was dreaming up this character, and in his teenage years, he had a traumatic event occur that I think reshaped his thinking about Superman and about himself. And that event was that his dad, who ran a used clothing store in a seedy neighborhood in Cleveland, one day had three guys come in and try on a suit and walk out with it without paying for it. And his father tried to stop them, and basically his heart gave way, and he had a massive heart attack and never made it alive to the hospital. And so for a young kid, he was the youngest of six kids of these Lithuanian immigrant parents, to suddenly lose his dad and his role model had him rethink his fantasy life as well as his regular life. And the character that he came up with at that point was no longer a bad guy. He dropped the, he dropped the hyphen, and he dropped the tough guy image. And the Superman that we see in his first rendition and in his buddy Joe Siegel's first drawing of the character was a hero who came in and was rescuing a guy who was being robbed, and a guy who I think looks suspiciously like Jerry Siegel's father, Michael Siegel.
Mm-hmm. There was also a sense of, as you talk about, a sense of Jewishness to this, and this heroic aspect had a particular resonance in the run-up to the Second World War and the Nazis coming to power.
It did. Very few times in our history has there been as perfect a coincidence between the fantasy story that a teenage kid like Jerry Siegel drew up and a country's need for a particular kind of hero. We were in the Great Depression in the 1930s. We were about to go to war in Europe. And the idea that the country needed a hero and this kid had created the perfect hero for us at that moment meant that almost from day one in the first Superman comic book, the character took off. And I think the character, and we can talk about this, had a particular Jewish flavor that wasn't just about the fact that Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster were two Jewish kids who dreamed him up, but it was Jews even more than the rest of America that particularly needed a hero in an era of Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin.
Do you think that this was anything that Shuster and Siegel consciously thought about or just sort of inadvertently evolved from their own life experience?
Well, they denied over the years that it was ever anything conscious. They were two quite secular Jews, and yet I think they grew up in a neighborhood that was 95% Jewish in Glenville, Ohio, and they were so infused with a Jewish consciousness that I think it was more than coincidence. It was more than coincidence that the name that Superman was given on the planet Krypton was Kal-El, which in Hebrew means the vessel of God. I think it was more than coincidence that his story in coming from the planet of Krypton seemed like it was taken directly out of the book of Exodus. The parents, in order to save their son, float him in outer space, and he is adopted in the middle of Middle America by two Gentiles named John and Martha Kent, and who quickly realize they've got an extraordinary kid who's going to go on and do great things. It was also at a time when all of Jerry's relatives in Eastern Europe were being destroyed in the Holocaust. The whole idea of the destruction of their home planet and their being rescued, the ultimate alien coming from the planet Krypton to Earth, he was the perfect diaspora Jew. But to me, the clincher is that any name like Superman's that ends in the word M-A-N is one of two things. It's either a superhero or a Jew.
The other thing that Superman was imbued with was a kind of, and continually was imbued with, was a kind of survivor guilt.
It was a huge survivor guilt. It was precisely the kind of survivor guilt that any newcomer to a country like America who had left behind relatives that they didn't know would make it, they have a certain amount of guilt. No diaspora and immigrant group in America had more of that kind of guilt than the Jewish community did in those days.
Why then, given that nerve that Superman touched, that Siegel and Shuster touched, why did Superman in the comic, why was it not subverted in more ways to the war effort?
Well, there was a danger there. On the one hand, Superman did take on Adolf Hitler and even Joseph Stalin before America did. He actually dragged Hitler back by the scruff of his neck to New York to be judged by an international court of justice. On the other hand, the danger was, and the danger that his handlers back at DC Comics were worried about is, if they sent Superman off to take on the Nazis and the Japanese, the risk was everybody would expect that he could do it in 5 minutes, and the sense that he was somehow sort of diminishing the sacrifice that our troops were making who were being wounded and killed overseas, it would have been mixing sort of this fantasy character who was a superhero with the work, the superheroic work of our troops. So they came up with a brilliant scheme, and the scheme was that Superman, in his alter ego personality of Clark Kent, went in to be tested. He wanted to be inducted into the military, and when he went in for his induction test, he took an eye test, and he failed his eye test. And the reason he failed his eye test was his X-ray vision, instead of reading the eye chart in front of him, was reading a chart two examining rooms away. And this was the perfect guise. Clark Kent can't even pass an eye test for reasons that we understand because of who the superhero was. So what it meant for DC Comics was Superman stayed home and helped protect the home front. He helped rally America to guard against saboteurs. When we had a bond drive or a paper drive or a metal drive, the military used Superman to help rally America to those drives. And the most effective, if you were trying to sell war bonds, the most effective salesman that the American military had during the war years was Superman, who also happened to be showing up in the form of his comic book in the ration kits that every American soldier overseas was getting.
Talk about the Clark Kent character and the softness of that character to the point that at various points people thought that he was gay.
So, Jeff, softness is a good word, and people did think he was gay. What I think is an even better word is the humanity of Clark Kent. That what Superman was trying to do and what I think Jerry Siegel was trying to do in creating this character, unlike the normal superhero, the superheroes who came after like Batman and Spider-Man and most superheroes, in those cases, the real character was Peter Parker. It was Batman's human alter ego, Bruce Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
In Superman's case, the real character was Superman. He's the guy who came from Krypton, and his disguise was Clark Kent. And I think what that disguise represented was Superman's attempt to try to relate to humanity here on Earth and trying to be human. And some people saw that as soft. A smaller number of people thought of it as gay. Superman's handlers worried over the years that they wanted to make sure that Clark Kent never was drawn in a way that suggested that he was gay. They were homophobic enough in that era. But I think what everybody was going for was a sense that this hero had a human side to him.
Was there concern by either Siegel and Schuster or by the handlers later on, which we'll talk about the fact that Superman was so much less dark than, say, Batman and Spider-Man, the other DC comics?
Well, you say concern, and I would say that was precisely what Jerry Siegel and Joe Schuster were going for. I think one of the reasons that Superman has lasted for 74 years and counting was precisely because he was this vision of light in a way that was more profound than with any other hero. That I think we've got in our world today, and in the world dating back to the 1930s, we had plenty of darkness like Batman. We had plenty of anxiety and fraughtness like Spider-Man. But we had one character who was so Dudley Do-Right-like that any time that we're facing anxiety and darkness in our world, we are drawn in an interesting way back to the clunky familiarity, but also the sense of rightness and righteousness of Superman.
There's a certain messianic quality to that.
An extraordinary messianic quality, and that is why Jews embrace him as the perfect sort of Moses story. Christians see it as a Christ-like story. God sends his only son to Earth to show humanity that it can be better than it thought it could be. The Buddhists think that Superman is the perfect Zen-like character, and atheists and agnostics see him as the perfect secular messiah, like you're saying.
One of the things that's interesting, you talk about the handlers, the way it all morphed in the 50s when there was what you call kind of the comic book scare. And what happened then?
What happened then was at the very time that Joseph McCarthy, Senator McCarthy, was creating the Red Scare and seeing a communist behind every government official and everywhere in our society, comic book censors started cropping up from the PTA to various clergy to various psychologists and psychiatrists who said comic books are corrupting our youth. They're too violent. They're too demeaning of women. There's too much sex in them. And Superman, while he was the least violent, and there was no sex that I could find going back and looking at Superman comic books, he was the leader of the superheroes, and he was the easiest target. And his handlers had to be very careful in those years. They tried to take out women entirely from the Superman stories for a while just to appease the censors. The good news was Superman survived nearly intact, and at a time when comic books generally were dying left and right and where comic book writers and artists were being put out of business, Superman persisted, and his artists and writers persisted as well.
What about, you talk about taking women out, the kind of triangle, almost like a love triangle, that existed between Superman and Clark Kent and Lois?
It was one of the brilliant triangles in the history of not just comic books, but of storytelling in the last century in America. I can't think of a more romantic story than that love triangle that was really between two people. And I can't think of, there was something called the moonlighting effect, that when this TV show Moonlighting came along,
mm-hmm.
and instead of a tease of an attraction, it became a marriage. One of the things that Superman's handlers learned was to keep the relationship for most of the life of Superman from being consummated. There were various times in the comic books and on one TV show where actually marriage did happen. But the idea of this relationship was brilliant. The idea of a Lois Lane-like character who was a strong woman, a great reporter, a professional woman, in an era when there weren't many professional female role models, that also created an attraction for young girls to see Superman, the whole Superman story, and Lois Lane in particular, as a role model.
You've talked a couple of times about Superman's handlers. Talk about who those handlers were, the DC Comics people, and the fact that Siegel and Schuster sold this whole idea for something like $150 or whatever it was.
Exactly. For $130 in 1938, as their first story was being published, they sold the rights forever to their character that would go on and earn billions of dollars for $130. And many people, including me, see that as the original sin of the comic book story. And on the other hand, Siegel and Schuster were hired for salaries that in those days of the 1930s, in today's terms, would be hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. It transformed their lives. They became celebrities. They became relatively rich. And it wasn't until they decided to sue to try to reclaim those rights that they ended up splitting up with DC Comics. In the early days, they had so much work trying to write their comic books and their comic strip stories that they were actually ghostwriters. The stories might have said Siegel and Schuster, but it was as likely that a guy named Alvin Schwartz was drawing their comic strips. There were various people over the years who came in as behind-the-scenes people and then as replacements for Siegel and Schuster, and they would draw Superman in ways that remained true to the basic character, but I think refined and perfected the story, the backstory, and the artistry of the way Superman looked on a printed page.
You talk about that they were making a lot of money for the day, but yet Schuster, in particular, you talk about, was constantly needing money and, in fact, did all of this outside work, this fetish work that you describe.
Well, he did that later. Joe Schuster had the two worst things happen to him that could happen to an artist. One is he was increasingly losing his eyesight. He wore glasses as thick as a Coke bottle, and he developed a palsy in his hand. And so he had a more and more difficult time. He went from drawing Superman to supervising other people who drew his body, and Schuster would just draw his face, to not being able to draw it much at all. And in later years, he was so down and out after he had parted ways with DC Comics that he drew fetish art for these pornographic publications, that it was only when an artist realized in a yard sale, got some of these old magazines, and looked and saw that these guys and women with whips and chains looked extraordinarily like Lois Lane and Jimmy Olsen and Superman, that he recognized and sort of alerted to the world to just how low Joe had sunk apparently in an attempt to earn enough to keep him alive.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things that you talk about is the evolution of Superman's character, even in the sense of doing good, that he started out as much more of, I mean, to use contemporary terms, much more of a social activist and became more a defender of the status quo.
He did. In the 1930s, when we were in the middle of the New Deal and the Depression, he was the consummate FDR, New Dealer, and liberal, taking on slumlords, taking on wife beaters. In the war years, in the 40s, he became this great defender of American virtue, the American way, and of the American troops. In the 1950s, when the Red Scare was happening, he took on the Red Menace. In the 1960s and 70s, when everything from hippie life to all of this counterculturalism was going on, Superman, for most of that era, defied that, and he became the defender of a status quo. In the Reagan era, when America was turning rightward, Superman and everything from his looks to his politics turned rightward. So there are two trends that define Superman over the years. One is he evolved as America was evolving, and he's the perfect lens into how popular culture reflected what was going on in a wider society. And the other is he remained true through all that evolution to the basic principles of righteousness that I think are what attracted people to Superman from the beginning.
What were the challenges in translating this to television?
Well, one challenge was finding a guy who could play Superman and Clark Kent and convince you that they were two different characters. And that challenge was met and not met both by a guy named George Reeves. George Reeves, when I close my eyes today and think of Superman, he was the first Superman I fell in love with, and he's the one I still think of as embodying Superman in those early TV adventures of Superman. And yet he was a pretty B-level actor. All he did in changing from Clark Kent to Superman was put on a uniform and take off his glasses. His voice stayed the same, and his whole demeanor stayed the same. He was a sort of tough guy Superman, but he was also, there was something about him that captured a sense that he believed in what he was doing in that acting that made us believe that he was truly two different characters, and he was almost winking at us and sort of taking us in on his secret of his dual identity so that we, and we meaning 15-year-old or 10-year-old kids like me, wanted to believe and did believe.
Talk about Superman the movie, and that was no easy task. You mentioned before lawsuits, and there's a long history of lawsuits, and I want to talk more about some of them. But the fact that the movie rights finally did get sold after so many years to the Salkinds, how did the original movie get made?
Well, it got made, ironically, by Alex Salkin, the father of this son and father, Ilya and Alex team. And Alex Salkin may have been one of the only guys on planet Earth who had no clue who Superman was at the beginning. And yet he knew something about making movies. And the Salkins took the risk that Warner Brothers wasn't going to take, that they could make Superman believable on the screen. They did that in part by hiring a brilliant director named Richard Donner from California and a great screenwriter named Mankiewicz, but they also brought on this extraordinary actor, Christopher Reeve. And the same way George Reeves, a generation before, had made kids like me believe that Superman was credible as a real flesh-and-blood character, Christopher Reeve made us believe in Superman, and he did what the marketers of that movie said that they were going to try to do, which is he made us believe for the first time that a man could fly. When Superman flew in the early TV serials and the early TV show, it was incredibly rudimentary, and he sure as heck didn't look like he was really flying. When Chris Reeve grabbed Margot Kidder / Lois Lane in his arms and took her off for a tour of the planet, I believe that the two of them were really flying.
Of course, one of the things that this gave way to with Christopher Reeves is the curse of Superman. Talk a little about that.
So the curse of Superman began back with Jerry and Joe selling him for $130. It continued when George Reeve ended up killing himself in a way that kids who saw the headline in the newspaper couldn't believe that Superman, even if he wanted to, could kill himself. And it took on its most powerful and tragic form when Christopher Reeve, the actor who had been in four Superman movies, had a horrible accident when he was riding a horse. He ended up essentially breaking his neck, and he came back entirely paralyzed. And yet, as he said in his memoir, and I think it was true, Christopher Reeve understood the character of Superman more when he was in the wheelchair fighting for the rights of people with brain injuries and spinal cord injuries. He was out there as their defender trying to raise money for stem cell research, and he said he understood truly what the Superman character meant and the goodwill he had built up with America when he was sitting in a wheelchair more than when he was flying as Superman.
Over the years, talk a little bit about who drove the Superman train. Who really shaped the character over so many years?
Well, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster and lots of the writers who came afterwards would say that it was them who did that. I'd say it was an equal balance between the people who wrote his scripts in the comic books and the comic strips and TV and the movies, and the behind-the-scenes money men at DC Comics, captured best by the first of them, Jack Liebowitz. And it was he who brilliantly understood how to market Superman, how to, on the one hand, push his writers to build up and puff up the character, and yet never to threaten the essential element. And they did it so carefully and skillfully that if it hadn't been for Jack Leibowitz, Jerry Siegel would have remained a frustrated teenager in Cleveland, Ohio, and the world would have never seen his character in the first place. And if it wasn't for Time Warner and Warner Brothers today and DC Comics, the writers and artists would not have this great setting where their character was out there in a million formats.
As you got into this project, were you surprised at how Superman had endured for so many years?
I was shocked at it. I had written about heroes in the past, guys like Satchel Paige, and I knew that even the greatest of our sports heroes or our political figures, I'm working on a book now on Robert Kennedy, and he's all about a certain kind of heroism, but politicians and sports figures fade. We've got them very short attention spans. The idea that the same character who was turning on kids and adults in 1938 could still do it today. We have a newly released Superman animated film out there this month of June. Next summer, we're going to have a new blockbuster film. The idea that Superman could survive for 74 years and counting, to me, is extraordinary.
Larry Tye, the book is Superman, the high-flying history of America's most enduring hero. Larry, it's been a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Jeff, thank you for having me back on.
Appreciate it.